Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Inclusive Class Podcast. Through interviews and discussions, it's our goal to explore the promise and practice of inclusive education. I'm Terry Morrow. I'm the author of 50 Ways to Support Your Child's Special Education, and I write about special needs for About.com at specialchildren.about.com. I am here this morning all by myself without my co-host, Nicole, who is taking a well-deserved vacation with her family, so we'll see how much I can screw it up while she's away. I'd like to mention to anybody out there listening to us live that we're not taking phone calls, and I am not opening the chat room because I have to actually pay attention every second today because I'm the only one interviewing. So in deference to our guest, I will focus entirely on what he has to say because it's a very important topic today. You know, a lot of the times on this show, we talk about the promise and practice of inclusion from a sort of an idealistic point of view. We speak with people who have experience with inclusion when it's done right. Nicole certainly has that experience of it done right. And I know that myself and a lot of parents have had a lot of experience with inclusion done wrong or completely denied. So I feel that my role in this show a lot of the times is to be the curmudgeon who comes in and goes, yeah, well, that sounds good, but you can't get that in real life. So today we're going to talk a little bit about what happens when you can't get it in real life and how parents can advocate and fight for inclusion and how you make the decisions about what your child needs and what you want to do about that. And we have to talk to us about that, about inclusion in special education law, our guest Charles Fox, here today to share his knowledge and experience with special education law. Welcome to the show, Charles. And can you start by telling our listeners what your background is and how you are involved with special education?
Thank you, Terry. And I have been an attorney representing families with special needs for 20 years, and it really began with representing my own son, who's now 21 years old. It's hard to imagine. He has CP, and he attends a transition program, and for most of his educational life, he was mostly included. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I morphed from a sort of general practice attorney into an attorney representing families with special needs.
Great. And you also, I should mention to everybody, have a great blog called the Special Education Law Blog, which has been one of my favorites to visit over the years. What is the address of that for everybody?
specialedlaw.blogs.com. And okay. I should add that I'm a mutual admirer of Terry and her work, which has really been comprehensively terrific over many years. I've been following her.
Oh, well, thank you very much. It's as we were talking about before the show started, we've sort of known each other on the internet and admired each other's work, so it's great to finally be talking to you and to be able to introduce you to all our listeners. So let's start by talking about the most important elements of effective advocacy for parents seeking inclusion and enforcement of their rights under IDEA.
Well, obviously, probably first and foremost is just understanding what your rights are and that, you know, that inclusion, what I always tell parents is that inclusion is not something that you have to earn your way into. It's something that the law presumes is the correct placement for your child. And what is inclusion? Inclusion is the school that your child would have gone to or should go to if your child did not have a disability. And inclusion is not something where, you know, well, if you want to swim in the deep end of the pool, well, that's cool, but, you know, but we're not going to do anything to help you, so take your chances and good luck to you. Rather, the legal definition of inclusion, again, presumes that it would be in the least restrictive environment, in other words, a neighborhood school with able-bodied peers, but, and this is the important but, with the provision of aids and services, and aids meaning people, aids meaning things, aids meaning tools like assistive technology, planning, training, support, and, you know, so that's sort of the message oftentimes gets sort of turned around that you have to earn your way in, but it's not like that.
Okay. And how does one persuade the people around the IEP table that that's the case?
I think probably one of the most important things is to humanize the child and to individualize mm-hmm. the child, you know, because even now, after doing this for almost 20 years, what I hear is, oh, I know CP kids, or I know
yes.
autistics. And, you know, and it may sound like sort of an idealized, you know, political correct thing, but it really,
uh-huh.
when people start using non-person first language, like I stated
yeah.
a moment ago, that's
mm-hmm.
always a bad sign. Because, you know, the first and foremost is that this is a student, this is a child, this is a young man or young woman who is a person first and,
right.
you know, and who happens to have a disabling condition. So I think,
mm-hmm.
I mean, the vehicle that I always recommend, and there are examples of it on my blog that I've used and some of my clients have used, is developing a parent input statement. And
right.
the idea of a parent input statement is that, first of all, it helps the parent crystallize their thoughts. Second
mm-hmm.
of all, it helps preserve time at the IEP meeting. And, you
yeah.
know, there are many, many purposes to the parent input statement. But most of all, it really tells the story. It tells the powerful narrative of the
mm-hmm.
student to the team. And I guess the other part of it is I look at advocacy as being not just you know, one shot and you didn't make it and then you walk away. I look at it a
yeah.
little bit as sort of like in those old movies about medieval times where you
mm-hmm.
take the big log and you bash the wall and it just dents it a little bit. But you just keep
uh-huh.
bashing until the
yeah.
wall gives way and then you make your
uh-huh.
way in. And so it's not an all or nothing. And, you know, today is a no, tomorrow is a no, but the third
yeah.
day may very well be a yes.
Yeah. That's a really good way of looking at it. That is definitely, and sometimes it feels like instead of the log, you're hitting the wall with your head.
yes, it certainly can. It certainly can.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, it can get so frustrating, and you know, sometimes there's retaliation by the school towards you or towards your child that can make it very. You know, very difficult to keep going and to know whether what you're fighting for is the right thing or whether you should just take what's available.
Well,
it's...
and one of the ways I try to turn things around, Terry, is,
mm-hmm.
you know, I try to look at it, I try as much as I can to look at it from the school's perspective and more to the
right.
point from the individual teacher's perspective saying,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I think there are well-meaning people out there.
Yes,
you know,
absolutely.
Teachers don't go into this to make $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I say, now, what would make the teacher's life easier? What would
right.
make the teacher more receptive to this
That's
concept,
a great point.
Which in theory, the teacher may, in fact, be receptive to, and
mm-hmm.
but he or she just doesn't know, sincerely doesn't know exactly
right.
how am I going to make this work. And that's where we bring in, you know, the other and critical part of the LRE mandate, which is
mm-hmm.
aids and services. And one, which... you know, after all these years, you know, it's gotten a little bit better with iPads,
mm-hmm.
but use
yeah.
of AT, assistive technology.
Yes.
And
right.
is what I say to parents and I say to staff is, look, you know, the student is a student. We don't need a better student. We need better
mm-hmm.
tools in the toolbox. And,
right.
you know, we try to put things on a constructive footing where, you
mm-hmm.
know, I'm not just simply folding my arms and quoting the law saying, I'm sorry.
Yes.
I don't give a blankety blank, you know,
right.
you have to do this because I'm a lawyer and I say so. Because the reality
yeah.
is at some point, very shortly, I go away and then
yes.
the teacher is left with the student in the classroom. So
yeah.
I'm looking for ways to, you know, if I make his or her life easier, meaning the teacher's life,
mm-hmm.
the teacher is going to, be more likely to ally him or herself with me, with the
right.
student, with the parent,
mm-hmm.
and actually look at this as being something that has not been imposed by some wise guy, big mouth lawyer, and
right.
but rather that he was actually considering my role and considering,
yeah.
you know, what tools I need, which oftentimes a teacher is a low person on the totem pole and really
yes.
cannot advocate for those kinds of tools and resources. But me as an outsider,
mm-hmm.
I can. And,
yeah.
and I have forged some fairly constructive relationships with teachers and because they realize I'm not just trying to impose some artificial mandate on them.
Yes. That's you know, very true and something I found really useful through the years, you know, to make those allies and also to offer as much as you can. You mentioned AT, but also certainly behavior plans and, you know, informing staff about things, helping with the they never get enough training, you know, especially the paraprofessionals who are the ones who have to work directly with your child often don't get the training they need and so fall back on their own experience as parents. And that's not necessarily appropriate for this particular child if the child has some behavioral special needs. So it's important as a parent to try to suggest as much as you can and to work with your team to share what works for your child as much as possible. Is there you find a lot of resistance to these tools?
Sometimes, you know, and it's funny because I sometimes find it with the very veteran teacher who's been doing it
uh-huh.
for a really long time. And
yeah.
I've been doing this for, you know, X number of years and don't
mm-hmm.
tell me how to change. Or sometimes I find
yeah.
it with the, and it's really surprising, the fresh out of school, freshly scrubbed new teacher
uh-huh.
and who sits there with their arms folded and says, I didn't learn that in school and, you know, so I don't have
yeah.
to do that. I didn't get in that line. I didn't sign up for that. And
yeah.
you know, it always amazes me when I see a teacher, a young teacher, you know,
mm-hmm.
otherwise, you know, one would expect would be open and excited and newly minted
yes.
and out in the world. And
that's what we'd hope for.
And I'm speaking in generalities because I certainly
yes.
have seen, you know, all teachers of all stripes and all number of years of service. Some very open to things, but
uh-huh.
you know, it is hard when you know if a person has a closed mind,
right?
That and is scared because that's really where
mm-hmm.
we fundamentally come down is
well,
being
sure.
scared that
mm-hmm.
You know you can offer them AT and it's like a plate of Brussels sprouts. So
yeah, I have a friend who has a daughter with a hearing impairment, and she got the, I guess there's like a microphone the teacher can wear, and she had that in the IEP, but the teacher got tired of wearing it, and so just kept taking it off partway through class. And,
yeah,
the FM
system, which
yeah,
which really
she,
is
you know,
an
she doesn't turn
tool.
Her ears on halfway through class. She really has to use it the whole time. So it
yeah,
just gets,
and,
go ahead.
Among my first cases was a child who needed an augmentative communication device, and,
uh-huh.
and the argument actually was, well, he can have it from 9 to 3, but he can't have it on the night or weekend. And the special ed director said, well, you know, I have children, too, and in school, and, you know, do they get to take their books home? And I said, well, actually, they do. And I said, more to the point, this is even more than books. This is... in this case, a young boy who
mm-hmm.
he needs to speak not just from 9 to 3, he needs to speak on
right.
nights and weekends, and he needs to practice
yeah.
the use of AT, and, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually went to mediation, which is a facilitated negotiation, and
mm-hmm.
it wasn't terribly long where the mediator, who was a strong mediator, she kind of, I think, took a metaphorical 2x4 to the director and said, come on, let's not be this.
Yeah. Yeah.
They ultimately agreed to giving him his voice 24/7.
Gosh. Yeah. Well, that's, you know, it seems to make so much sense, but people sometimes just get so locked into the way things have been done or the way things are on paper, and they don't use common sense. I know a lot of the times with behavior supports also, my son always had a paraprofessional as a behavioral support, but, you know, she comes in like half an hour into the day and then she leaves a half an hour before the end of the day. And it's like, well, you know, he still has the same issues those two half hours. How can you just say, well, you know, okay, now behave for the next half hour. So that's all, especially when you're in an inclusive classroom, that's, you know, becomes an issue to be able to have access to that stuff. And have it done in a well-thought-out and commonsensical way. is always.
And then well thought out, especially, and I'm shocked, Terry. You know, with this half an hour at the beginning and half an hour at the end. I mean, that is just astoundingly systemically wrong.
Yes, well thought out.
You know, which I always. I'm amazed when I'm looking at behavior plans and data, which feeds into it, is that we're collecting hash marks in terms of frequency data. I had a student once who his behavior was screaming in class, and they came in with like a train schedule, 9 to 9:10, 9:11 to 9:20, and in those like 9 or 10 minute periods, they would say, well, he screamed 47 times, or he screamed 26 times, and I turned to the lawyer, whose name happened to be Terry as well, and who I regard as a friend and a colleague, and I said, you know, I'm not trying to be a wise guy. I just don't know how you scream 46 times in a 9 minute period. And but really the point that I was making is that when we're doing behavioral planning, there are 6 things that we always need to look for in order to do it well. And that's looking at the antecedent, the behavior, consequence. In other words, we're putting it in a context. And then we're looking at the intensity, the duration, and the frequency. So hash marks are part of it, but it's only one of 6. And what I say as a general matter is that in order to really understand it, in order to really address it, in order to make a meaningful and constructive difference in behavioral planning, you have to understand it in context, in an objective, non-judgmental, non-pejorative viewpoint. And when we put it in context, we understand better, or able to plan for better, able to support better in a way that it's not like, okay, if you scream more than 24 times, you know, now you've earned that punishment that we've been waiting to give you. Which really, at the end of the day, is not what it's about at all.
No, no. Yeah, it's the behavior. The behavioral support still seems to be something that, that people really struggle with, and there are such good ways to do it, and such well-known ways to do it that it seems almost willful sometimes the lack of support that schools give for that. But I could talk about that for another 45 minutes. It's something that came up quite a lot.
Sure.
But I want to get on
I would say more than half my cases are have some element of behavior in them, at least half.
Yeah, that's the big thing. And that's, you know, I want to get on to, I know you wanted to talk something about transition planning for students in high school and beyond. That's something that both of my kids have recently gone through. And now I have my son's best friend just graduated and is transitioning to not anything for certain. So it's something that I think parents need to really be thinking about as early as possible and planning for and pushing the schools to plan for. So what have you found on that subject? What have you worked on with that?
Well, it's really interesting. You know, those are, it's not really a development, but it's a prospect. And, you know, Senator Menendez from New Jersey, just about 2 weeks ago, proposed new legislation. I don't know if you've talked about this or not. And,
we have not.
I'm glad you are. There's a new bill that he introduced, which, you know, I think is being referred to generally, and I put it up on my Twitter site, which is at Special Ed Lawyer. And the idea is that post-transition, there would be funding for a role of what they call a transition navigator, which would now continue to support and help guide the transition process. But I think, Terry, I think the point that you raised a moment ago, sort of on the other end of things, is really critical. The IDEA, the federal statute, calls for transition planning. In other words, what happens after you leave high school to occur at least beginning at 16. In Illinois, where I am, it occurs at 14 and a half. There's nothing in the law that says that we can't have consideration of transitional needs, you know, well before 14 and a half and certainly well before 16. And, what I argue is that from the first IEP, you know, we need to be looking at, you know, well, how does this relate to where the child is ultimately going, where we think the child is going, and what the child will need when they get there, which you know, I mean, and again, not to bring it back to behavioral planning, but if a child has, you know, severely antisocial behaviors at 2 or 3, you know, those aren't going to get any better at 14 or 15 or 20. And so when we're looking at something that might be cute, you know, in a 3-year-old, it's really going to be, it's going to be perhaps, you know, a serious violation of law and violation of people's personhood, you know, when they're 14 or 15. I mean, and so transition planning is, you know, it includes things like orientation and mobility. How can the child or young adult, you know, move through the community? And one of the things that I guess troubles me is that, you know, I see sort of a uniformity across many transition plans, and, which is, I have, like, so many students, their transition plan says they're going to go into culinary arts. You know, I'm all for cooking, and I'm certainly all for eating. And, and I think that, you know, at least in theory, sounds like a great idea. But when you break down what it means to work in a kitchen, you know, of any sort, it's fast-paced. There's lots of things like hot liquids and sharp objects. And people screaming, and people running, and you know, I mean, many of my students have issues with processing speed. They have issues with communication, and I mean, this is almost a recipe for disaster.
Right.
As opposed to taking sort of, again, a less parochial, broader view, where we're looking at, like, there was a meeting that I had where the subject was brought up of a 2-year degree. If anyone's ever been to, like, say, a conference at a big hotel where there's actually a 2-year degree for the man or woman to set up the audiovisual, you know, microphones and things like that. And it's a surprisingly, you know, the entrance level salary was surprisingly decent, and their certificate programs around the country, just as a for instance. And, and, you know, it's quiet, it's unhurried, no one is screaming at you, there's no hot liquids or sharp objects, you know, in play. And you're working generally for a large corporation where there may be benefits and, you know, there may be room for advancement, you know, so looking at certificated programs as sort of an end for transition planning, sort of, again, broadening out the view. You know, even working as a veterinary technician, or you know, or some other areas that, you know, it can't be childcare, culinary arts, and janitorial service. That seems to be like the three big ones. And for some students, this may be very applicable. But that's not the totality of the end goal of transition planning for a large majority of students.
Yes, yeah, having more creativity in that. I mean, there certainly seem to be more availability of college programs to kids with disabilities and developmental disabilities and intellectual disabilities as well as physical disabilities. That wasn't there 10 or 12 years ago. So
It's amazingly true. And I see, now, I was just speaking to a family the other day of a 5 or 6-year-old with autism, and the child has, you know, they're showing some really great gains, has really done a great job. And, you know, this is a fairly young child, and, you know, and I say, you know, 10 years ago, the programs to support kids, you know, high-functioning kids and other kids with autism, as a for instance, in college, was fairly unusual. Now, it's fairly common. I said, you know, in 13 years, when your kid is 18 or 19, it's just going to be just fairly commonplace. And wraparound programs, you know, someone to knock on the door to make sure the child is not just staying in their room and playing video games. And, and just, you know, not an IEP, but more than just a simple 504, hey, you're on your own, and good luck to you.
It's very encouraging, and my kids are both in community college now, and I just go and hang out during the day with them, and just to see the diversity in terms of you know, disabilities on the campus and how accepted everything is, and how they seem to be, getting the help they need and yet still having some independence is really inspiring. And I hope that transition coordinators are taking note of this and considering that as an option, you know, so that it's, you know, for years it was sort of like, well, your kid can't go to college. Well, that's not something that's realistic. But it's realistic now. It's for more and more kids, I think. And
one thing that I would say, too, is that, I mean, first, God bless community colleges. And,
yes,
that's
absolutely.
That's really terrific to hear about your kids. And the other thing that I've discovered is that in my area, I'll just pick a number, there's 4 or 5 community colleges that are close
mm-hmm.
by. And
yeah.
if you ask sort of similar questions as far as what supports are available,
mm-hmm.
you get a fair diversity of opinion in terms of, well,
right.
we don't have to do that. And
yeah.
then 4 miles up the road, the next
uh-huh.
college says, oh, yeah, we're perfectly fine with that. So,
yeah.
so I would say to parents, if you have that in mind, and I think that's certainly something that should be pursued, you know,
mm-hmm.
and you're getting a negative vibe from this or that disability coordinator at this or that community college, look at another one. Because there are several in my area that are amazingly, amazingly supportive. And then there are some
mm-hmm.
that are amazingly not supportive. And,
yeah.
So don't be discouraged if you're not getting the positive message from, you know, College X, because there may be one up the road where it's going to be exactly the opposite.
And it is so nice, you know, for parents who have gone through the school system and had to battle with, had no choice as to who they had to battle with, they have to deal with their school system, to have choice, you know, to be able to say,
yeah.
to be able to pick the school that's going to be the best for your kid and to be able to work with them and, you know, to be able to make these decisions without having to sit down with a table full of people and you know, have a meeting and get everybody's signature on the document. It's really nice. I did a little dance after I had my last IEP meeting. And
I can only imagine.
Though there's certainly challenges, you know, at the relatively on your own college level, it's nice to be able to make your own decisions based on what you think
yeah.
is best for your kid. To have that opportunity. And certainly I think that certificate programs, as you mentioned, is something that, you know, every parent should be looking at to see if there's something that would interest their kid.
Well, I think if Senator Menendez's bill, you know, gains any traction, I'm sure that would also help, you know, in terms
mm-hmm.
of, like, kids in a position like your children are and other kids as well. And so, you know, because it's not as if at 21 or 22 that things just come to an abrupt halt in terms of needs and in terms
yeah.
of making a meaningful life for
mm-hmm.
this young man or this young woman.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely the next step when it comes to inclusion, because as we get more and more kids who are in inclusion all through school, and then high school ends and all their friends go off to college or whatever and there's nothing there for them, and they go back into a segregated program, that's not what we're shooting for. It's like,
no,
what
and,
were we doing
you know,
all that for in order for them to then go to a day program? It's not, you know, there has to be an inclusive step after school. So.
Well, as you know, my wife writes a column for my blog, and
yeah,
and you know, and one of the jokes that she makes on the blog is that you know you're in trouble if your transition plan is a TV guide.
Yes,
and,
sadly,
and
not as far
sadly.
From reality as we would like. Well, unfortunately, that was the school bell saying we've gotten to the end of our time, not to the end of our questions and the end of our conversation, unfortunately, but I hope we can have you back sometime in the future. I think you've got some great stuff to say, and I know that parents and schools need to hear it. So thank you so much for being our guest today and for being with me solo here on my first solo outing. And I would like to thank
great,
our...
Terry, and my pleasure.
Thank you, and you did great as well. I would like to thank our listeners for tuning into our program this morning. Please join us for next week's show when I will talk with Amy Fenton Lee about making not just our schools but our churches more inclusive. In the meantime, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where Nicole tweets under the name inclusive_class, and I am at Mamatude, MAMATUDE, and you can follow Charles Fox at Special Ed Lawyer. And finally, you can download our past podcasts for free on Stitcher and iTunes. Goodbye, everybody, and have a great week.